Welcome to the program. It's a podcast of the cinema.
Inspired by actual accounts of an NYPD sergeant.
Yes, based on a true story. Ooh.
This is a, I gotta scroll up.
Oh, here. Who's messing up the intro now?
No one is messing up the intro. Uh-huh. I'm continuing to do the intro. Mm-hmm. You are stepping on my, my.
Do go on then.
Stepping on my everything. Here.
Continue.
This is Linoleum Knife. We're a podcast of the cinema. Mm-hmm. I'm Dave White from nowhere, and you're Alonzo Duralde from south of nowhere, and we are film critics for different places. Different places.
Different places.
We shop at CVS with coupons.
It's very exciting.
We went mattress buying this week. Mm-hmm. The reason? We're married. New listeners.
Surprise!
Yeah.
Not to spoil anything.
All right.
Yes, purchases were made this week, and it was so July 4th.
Yeah. They were having all their mattress sales.
That's right. Big mattress
sales. That's what you do on the 4th of July.
When you are old, boring, married people.
You celebrate your independence from the cruddy mattress you've been sleeping on for
it's the worst
20 years, and then, more like 7.
Something like that, but it's...
When you're fat, you bust them out real quick. Mm-hmm.
So this mattress has had a life of service, and now it's going to go live on a farm with other old mattresses.
It's going to run around and play in the clean air.
That's right.
And be free.
While we replace it with a new, sturdy, firm mattress.
We're talking about a cinema thing as well here, because we're just going to get right into it. We bought this mattress after seeing Deliver Us From Evil.
Mm, yes.
We had to go.
It would have benefited to have that mattress during Deliver Us From Evil.
We had to go for a nice nap. We had to go to the Burbank Media Center. Is that what they call that mall? Mm-hmm. Is it still the Burbank Media Center?
Yes. Which makes it sound like it's part of the show business.
I know.
But it's really just a sad, sad mall.
Oh, it's the best.
That has Magnifique Mademoiselle. Or Mademoiselle Magnifique. I can never remember. It's like, here's what this mall is like. If you were making a movie that was set in a mall, but you could not get product placement clearance with any actual brands, and you had to make up sort of like generic facades for things like perfume and makeup, or, you know, shoe time or something. That's what this mall looks like. It feels like you're in a set of a crappy movie that couldn't get real stores in there.
All the stores are real, but all of them are independently owned and operated.
They all seem like fronts to me.
There is the famed Magnifique Mademoiselle.
Yes. Which did not have their
logo is a tiger.
Tiger. It did not have the wow. It did not have their Golden Globe and Oscar season sign up. Really?
Yes,
I didn't see it.
It's up year round, apparently.
I did not see it. I was looking for it.
Buy your Golden Globe and Academy Award gowns.
By the way,
here, for those layaway available.
If you are fashion minded, they are hiring.
They're also hiring. I learned that. There's also a tuxedo shop across from Magnifique Mademoiselle. Its name is Tuxedo Junction. Mm-hmm. There is perfume. Wait, what's the name of the place? Perfumes and
makeup, I thought.
And cosmetics or
Something like that. Yeah. Again, just as perfumes generic as you can
and
get.
And cosmetics.
They should just all say store.
Glitz with a Z. Is that how you spell glitz anyway?
Is glitz always spelled with a Z? Yes.
It just looks wrong on the sign, no.
Wasn't that like a... What was that line on Project Runway that time where the guest judge said that it looked like the kind of dress you would pick up in a mall store called, like, you know, foibles or something?
Like raffles or spangles or something like that.
That's the kind of store you would find at the Burbank Media Center.
What's interesting to me about the Burbank Media Center, other than... everything.
Is they that, do have a hot dog on a stick in the food court. I'll give them that.
All but one of the food court places are chains that you would know from every food court in the world. The one that is not from a chain is the best place in the mall. I believe it is called Tamale House. If you ever find yourself in the Burbank Media Center 8, you need to eat your lunch at Tamale House.
Why are you telling me this now? Why did you take me to hot dog on a stick when we could have had good tamales?
Tamale House is slower. You go in and you sit down. It's like a restaurant.
You were in that much of a hurry to get to mattresses? We couldn't have had a nice tamale? Hurry. I was not.
You were the one that was tapping your watch going, we got to get back. I have a million things to do. Outfest emails. Having a conniption.
Oh, fine.
That was you.
But you could have...
I could have lolled around all day at the Burbank Media Center.
Hey, so much to see.
A lot of experiences could have been had in that mall.
Okay, fine. That's on me. I'll take it.
There would have been... We would have been our own scenes from a mall in the Burbank Media Center 8.
And we will be talking later about the late Paul Mazursky.
Why don't you just talk about it right now? Well, in the middle of talking about delivery
we hadn't even gotten
mattress
there yet.
Shopping. There are so many digressions that can fit into this story and make it all one thing.
Yeah, our lives are like the bad
crash. Rich and
complicated. Everything is interweaving and all connected.
Talk about Paul Mazursky.
Paul Mazursky passed away this week, and he is, I think, an undersung member of the Hollywood 1970s bunch.
An unmarried woman.
Yes, an unmarried woman.
Movie.
Bloom in Love, Alex in Wonderland, and then later on, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, and Tempest, and Scenes from a Mall, a movie that I will defend, that I think is actually pretty good.
I've actually never seen
He was also
Scenes from a Mall.
Also a creator.
Other than that, it was shot.
Exteriors were shot here at the Beverly,
Center.
And then the interiors were shot, I think, in Westport, Connecticut.
I love mall movies because they're almost all of them are made here. And I love being like, I know that mall, I know that mall, I know that mall.
But yeah, I think
I'm a big fan of malls.
Yeah, you are.
I grew up as a child.
No, we are.
In the 70s and 80s. And
generation mall, for
malls,
sure.
And malls are great, and they're dying, they're going away. And they're being replaced by terrible places where you have to walk outside.
Yes.
And that is bad.
And live above the Victoria's Secret.
Walking outside is not good for anyone or fun. It rains out there or it's hot and you sweat.
That's more likely
the case in this city.
When we become spunky senior citizens.
Not into it.
Where will we mall walk?
There will be one somewhere.
There better be.
If we get old... And go back to Atlanta, where your family is, because someone there is going to have to, tend to us. Because we're going to be 100 and doddering around and bumping into each other.
And writers who never made any money.
Breaking all our hips all the time. I thought about that recently, how, we're both going to get super old.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any kids. And so... So we're going to have to go somewhere where your family is so people can take turns checking in on us. So we don't...
We'll be the drain.
So we don't fall down and die somewhere.
Undiscovered.
Undiscovered, yeah. Anyway, because when you get old, you just need help. You need to give up your ideas about being hardy and,
Independent
when you get old. You just got to do it. Mm. You just got to allow the people in your family to be like, no, we'll come check in on you.
Yeah.
Anyway,
wear your life alert or whatever.
Yeah. So now if we go to Atlanta, they're going to always have malls in Atlanta.
I hope so.
Yeah. Like that one that you used to live near, that you worked at, that movie theater at, right?
No, the movie theater was not inside a mall.
What was the mall where you used to live?
The mall down the street from me growing up was Greenbrier Mall.
Greenbrier, that's still there. Though,
in East Point, it is still there.
That's kind of like, but
it's like it's super on the other side of town where all my siblings.
And it's kind of like Burbank Media Center 8, where all the stores are sort of independent,
a little bit
mom and pop kind of stores.
Yes,
those are my favorite malls. Those luxury malls are a dime a dozen. Do I need to go to another mall that's got a Prada in it?
You like going to South Coast Plaza.
South Coast Plaza is different. South Coast Plaza is for Christmas. It's the Christmas mall.
True. It's like Disneyland.
They decorate it for Christmas, and then you go there, mm-hmm. and you wander around it, and you're like, look, Christmas is happening. Check it out. Look at that giant weird tree they've got in the middle of it all with the train that runs around it and
stuff. We have to go back for the handbell choir this year.
And the handbell choir.
They were great.
So, That's different. Anyway, there'll be malls in Atlanta when we get old. Okay, okay, so Paul Mazursky.
So Paul Mazursky, yeah.
He died.
And
how old was he?
I don't have it in front of me. 80-something, I think. He was around. He was a character actor in the 50s. Like, he's in the Blackboard Jungle.
Really?
Yeah, he's like one of the teen hoods.
I've never seen the Blackboard Jungle.
It's the kind of movie that you look at now and you realize that it inspired 10,000 other movies
that
you've
seen. You
would
think that it would have when I used to be a middle school teacher.
Indeed,
I was
yeah.
super into watching all those teacher movies.
it's
pointing
you know,
out the wrongness exactly. of almost all of them.
It's it's the kind of movie where it was so influential that you've seen it. You've seen it, even though you think you haven't, because
right.
you've seen Class of 1984, or you've seen however many other
Class
movies.
Class of 1984 is the best teacher movie.
Well, Class of 1984 is totally ripping off the Blackboard Jungle, like down to specific plot beats.
I know, but they've got, you know, punk rock fashions.
Yes, and Roddy McDowell. Yeah. So then Mazursky was one of the creators of the Monkees show.
Really?
Yeah.
Here's holy things I did not know. About Paul Mazursky.
Yeah, no, he's fascinating. And then you know, like I said, he was really part of that kind of 70s rebel generation. I don't know if his direct contact with, you know, Rafelson and the company, oh God, I'm blanking on the name. There was just the Criterion just did that big box set about them. They did Head, they did Easy Rider, they did King of Marvin Gardens and
yes.
Five Easy Pieces.
Yes.
You some Bibbs is screaming it at the radio right now. But anyway,
yeah.
I don't know if he was directly involved with those cats, but I'm sure that helped his segue into making feature films. Alex in Wonderland is, you know, Fellini plays himself in that movie.
Right.
it's Mazursky's 8 1/2, which he made really early. Oh, of course. Sorry, his big breakthrough movies, which I forgot to mention, is Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice.
Yes. I have seen that.
Yeah, I think he's
swinging.
He's a smart filmmaker. He has, I think, a great sort of observer of human behavior. Next Stop, Greenwich Village is another one that that's one I need to see. I've never seen it, but I hear it's great. I think he was terrific. I got to meet him in 1997.
Yep.
He came to the USA Film Festival. We honored him. And presenting the tribute to him was Molly Ringwald,
yes.
who he put in movies first.
Yes.
Her big screen debut was in his 1982 Tempest, which was a loose adaptation of the Shakespeare play
yes.
set in the modern
like Susan
day.
Susan Sarandon played her mom or something?
No, Susan Sarandon plays Miranda.
Oh, okay.
Molly Ringwald's parents in that movie are John Cassavetes and Gina Rowlands.
Oh, that's right.
Gina Rowlands. Vittorio Gassman's in that movie, Raul Julia. I love that film. I'll just say it now. It's my DVD pick this week because it's a Mazursky movie and it's a Susan Sarandon movie, and we'll be talking about Tammy shortly.
My DVD pick of the week is The Raid 2. It comes out Tuesday. Nobody went to see it. You're dumb if you didn't go see it. It's 5 hours long. It's all fighting and murder, and it's beautiful.
I would
go
say
see it.
That The Raid 2 is an argument for...
Well, not go see it. Go get that DVD.
I would say that it's an argument for dubbing certain movies.
I don't care.
Because I think that...
Words are not important
I think
in
that,
The Raid.
Exactly. And I think that action fans would have gone to see that movie were it not subtitled.
Action fans are idiots if that's what kept them away from it.
That's my conjecture.
You heard me. Idiots.
I'm thinking that's
was
that's
Paul
the
Mazursky the guy that hung out at the farmer's market
yes,
every Friday?
Yes, he was. I don't know what those guys are going to do without him. He had a whole table of ultra-cockers who would meet every Friday at the farmer's market and just, like...
Right next to Bob's Coffee and Donuts.
Yeah.
We'd get our donuts and then...
There they'd be, schmoozing for hours.
Dude, well, schmoozing's probably the wrong word.
Well,
just yakking it up.
Yeah. When we honored him at LAFCA a couple years ago...
I could never figure out who... I knew there was like this table of old guys, and I knew that one of them was a director, because you mentioned it in passing one day.
I forget who now.
And
there was a film critic we know who hung out in that group, and...
I don't know who that was. But the... I didn't recognize anybody, but I remember one day you said, oh, that's blah, blah, that's Paul Mazursky. I guess that's what you said. And it just left my head. So I was like, oh, Paul Mazursky, he's old now. And he does that thing that old people do. They get a schmear and hang out. They go to get bagels and coffee, and they sit around and talk all morning with their other old people friends.
No, when we honored him at LA Film Critics several years ago with the Career Achievement Award, like that whole posse, like, bought like two tables and they all came.
Oh, did they all come?
Yeah, it was great.
Did I miss that year? I might have missed that year.
That was Molly Ringwald was there at that too.
Oh, then I missed that.
Oh, see, that was what was so great because
some
that,
years I miss
that. What was
of
so
the Lafka dinner?
What was so cool about that year was she came, you know, for, as part of the tribute to him.
Yes,
and we were honoring, I think, film socialisme.
So great.
Won the
awesome.
I think it won the experimental award that year.
Deservedly so.
And of course, since Monsieur Godard was not in attendance to accept, David Ehrenstein went up to Molly Ringwald and said, "Hey, you were in a Godard movie. Would you mind accepting this?"
Oh yeah, you did tell me about that story.
She did. It was great.
Because I remember thinking, why wasn't I there for this one?
Yes, you missed a good one.
Yeah, she wasn't. She was in Godard's King Lear in the '80s.
Yes.
After she ran away. She ran away to France.
No, that was before that.
Oh, was it before she ran away to France?
This was like 1987. This was still part of...
Oh, this was in the middle of her being Molly Ringwald.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, are you sure? Like, I thought it was in the 90s.
No. Lear was I screened it in college, so and I graduated in 88.
Oh, all right.
So, yeah. No, it was like... It's like pre The Pickup Artist, I think. Like, it's in that sort of segue period. Like
fascinating. I thought that film was from the 90s.
Yeah, no. It's like for keeps-ish period.
I'm an idiot. And so, but yeah, so I remember that she, I guess I didn't hear about it until the 90s. Nobody talked about her going off to do a Godard movie in the 80s.
Well, it was a canon film that barely got released. I mean, it had its Nashville premiere when I screened it at Vanderbilt. You know, it did not even get like a cursory sort of 1 week art house dump. It was, I think it probably played New York and L.A. and maybe a few other places.
I'm just looking it up right now. 1987. You're right.
And I have a terrific one sheet for that film, thanks to our friend Joe, who gave it to me for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Got a frame.
It is a really good poster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that is a poster I wouldn't have a problem
displaying in the home.
Like, you had, when we met, you had way too many movie posters.
Yeah, wow.
And you and Robert, I remember when you guys were roommates. Well, I don't remember when you guys were roommates, but when you guys were roommates, you took photographs of the ghastly interior of your apartment, your messy, messy, messy apartment, where every square inch was covered with movie posters.
No.
That's
my bedroom, I completely papered the walls with movie posters.
I saw the living room area where...
The living room had maybe one or two.
All kinds of posters that were clearly put there by Robert. But y'all's idea of decorating a home was thumbtacking movie posters to the walls.
Yeah, well, we were young. It was the 90s.
It's not right, but it's okay.
That was before I met you to come fix my life.
To come fix your life, which is what I did. I see it, and I'm like, that's a really cool poster.
It is a very cool poster.
Yeah. So...
So anyway, R.I.P. Paul Mazursky, you were awesome.
Yes.
If you're not familiar with like his films beyond...
I bet his friends will all still hang out, though. They'll
still show up, yes.
Yeah.
Like Swallows to Capistrano.
Because would that be a bummer if there was only one person that was the glue, and they're like, oh, we can't do that anymore. Like, you should keep doing that.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Check next week.
Like,
next
he would want that to happen, right?
He would
stop going to get donuts. You know?
Exactly.
I mean, you, obviously, when I die, I want you to, go into...
We talk about this a lot on this program.
Mourning like Lady Mary. Like, you need to be,
Oh, I can't... Wearing 6 months until Violet?
Sequestered and...
Or maroon or what?
We talk about your death frequently on the show.
We talk about one of us dying first or what were the other ones going to do if we die.
Do we do it? Is it too often?
I'm starting to think it might be. Just a little.
I don't think it's too... No, here's the thing. Maybe we do. But it is only a mirror of how often we talk about it in real life.
True.
I think
all couples do this.
The reason we don't talk about it off the mic a lot is because I like to be prepared for all the plan, all the things that could happen. All the things that you know are going to happen, you should try to be prepared for them. You know, so many things are unplannable that the things you know are coming down the road, i.e. your spouse's death, You gotta plan for those things.
Dave's life is so structured that he honestly believes that one day he's going to go into the doctor's office and he's going to come in carrying a clipboard with one of those graphs where the line is going down, down, down. And he's going to grab his chin and be all fur and say, Dave, I'm afraid you have only 6 months to live.
Exactly six months.
6 months to the day. So that Dave can then plan for those next 6 months how he will, you know, disburse his estate, say farewell to his loved ones.
I will have already dispersed my estate via legal documents by that point. But the...
You box everything up for goodwill. Yes. Like you think it's going to be that
organize
tidy.
Everything and, you know, bring things to a close and allow people who have wronged me in any way to come to me begging for forgiveness.
You will be...
Which I will grant. I will bestow upon them the absolution they require. And
I think you will be hit by a...
They will weep grateful tears. Then we'll have some cake. And then during my final weeks, I will retire to my home and I will receive visitors who will come to me and say, "Goodbye, Dave. You were the best person in the history of everybody." And we'll have tea and there'll be more cake. And then I'll go to bed. Like the last week, I'll just be in bed. Really nice sheets. Everything clean.
Silk pajamas.
Nothing dirty in the house. All the dishes are done. Like, someone else is handling that. Everything's going to be...
All the cake put away.
Everything's going to be great. And then you'll already be gone because you have to go first. Because I can't stand the thought of you living in another messy apartment. Ruining my clean home. And you'll be sad and lonely, and you won't know how to take care of yourself because I've been assisting you all these years in an indispensable fashion. So that's how it's going to be.
Whereas I think you're going to
actually, I'll also be 102 years old.
You will randomly be hit by
between 100 and 105 years old. I think that's an appropriate age. Because then I will have hit my century. I will have been on the Today Show, on the Smucker's label. Whatever the weatherman is at that point will say, "Dave White, you were so great. You still are. Look, you're 100. And now you're on the Blackberry Jam Smucker's label." Because Blackberry Jam is the best.
I think that you will be struck by a heretofore undetected piece of Skylab. And it will take you out like that.
No, it will be random and chaotic and fast. No. It will be orderly. And there will be plans made. And agenda items met.
Checked off.
In my
keep telling yourself that.
In my 2066 at a glance.
Because that's how everyone's life works.
That's how mine's going to be. I don't know about you. You can go chaotically and weird for all I care. You know, like that's, you can do it. Knock yourself out. Have an abrupt death if that's what you want. I'll pick up the pieces and make sure everything is organized for your interment and memorial service and stuff.
You crazy.
I'm organized. That's just what I am.
Okay, so anyway, meanwhile, at the Burbank Media Center...
We're at the Burbank Media Center.
Delivers from Evil.
And we go see Delivers from Evil. It sucks. Oh, by the way...
2 hours!
It is 2 full hours long. It stars Eric Bana and Joel McHale of The Soup. Yeah, he's the guy you want in a horror movie.
As a tough NYPD cop?
He's comic relief.
Yeah, but he's also supposed to be a badass.
He's a badass, too, because if you, like...
He wears a Boston Red Sox cap in the hopes that people will try and beat him up.
T-shirts, like, you never see him on The Soup in T-shirts, but the dude has gigantic arm muscles that have never been shown on camera, I think, until
right
now.
He's hiding a gun show under all those Hugo Boss blazers.
And you know...
Or at least he made one for this movie.
He's the tough dude who wants to beat up everybody and stab him with a knife and... there's a bad thing that comes from Iraq.
Yes.
The war, it's in a cave.
Which is not unlike the beginning of The Exorcist and Exorcist 2.
That is correct. Soldiers bring it back to the Bronx. Leave the Bronx. Before the bad thing gets to you.
Reminding everyone to leave the Bronx.
And then Eric Bana, his wife is Olivia Munn. They have some little daughter who owns the last vintage Jack in the Box toy
right
in the United States. And because it is a vintage Jack in the Box toy, that's where the bad thing decides. Oh, look, it's my phone that I forgot to turn off. Like, it matters.
Way to go, phone.
Well, you know what? We're full of ambient noise today anyway, because it's hot outside.
Windows are open.
All the windows are open. The door's wide open. We are like Keira Knightley recording an album.
Under the Brooklyn Bridge.
Under the Brooklyn Bridge in that movie.
Begin Again.
Whatever it is. Oh, it's from Sears. That's so funny. It's thank you for your purchase. You'll receive up to 6 messages, RE, your Sears delivery.
Wow.
Which is going to take place on the 21st of this month.
Exciting.
Monday the 21st, that new mattress is coming. We walked into... So
I have to sleep on the crappy old mattress all the way through Outfest.
Yeah. Deliver Us from Evil is about an exorcism and boring stuff, and
here's the thing:
it's fake. It's not fake. Well, it's all fake because it's about an exorcism. And if you think every you've got a demon in you, here's how you know:
every exorcism movie has the same structure. It's like going to see yet another movie about the life and death of Jesus. You know what points they're going to touch upon.
Yes,
and in this one, you know there's going to be like the person behaving all weird and doing terrible things and speaking in dead languages and, you know, twisting their bodies in weird ways, and the person who doesn't believe it, and the radical priest, you know, who's not sanctioned by the Vatican, but everyone knows right. that he's the guy, and then the last 10 minutes is the priest yelling at the person who's spazzing out and bleeding out of his eyeballs and, you know, shrieking.
Right. And there's nothing that you haven't seen here before in a million horror movies, a million exorcist movies, a million cop movies. It's always dark and rainy.
Yeah.
It's just tired.
And a lot of really good people are in it. You know, Edgar Ramirez is the priest, and you know, all those other guys
are smoking, drinking, womanizing,
leather jacket,
heterosexual, stud priest. Great hair.
Priest. Used to be a heroin addict priest. Yeah,
he's seen it all. The devil apparently really loves the music of the Doors. That's an ongoing theme in the film. And they're right. The devil does love the Doors. The Doors are terrible. That's if you're a Doors fan and you're listening and you have taken offense that I have just triggered something in you, too bad. They suck.
And if you are a Marvel fan who is looking at this movie to see how this guy's going to handle the Doctor Strange movie,
you will not find out. I don't know what happened here, because this is the same guy, and I'm blanking on his name. He directed Sinister, which I thought was so great.
Derrickson?
Look it up, phone. Sorry, we're unprepared with the director's name of this terrible film. But he is the guy who made Sinister.
And the Exorcism of Emily Rose?
Which is whatever. The Exorcism of Emily Rose is...
Scott Derrickson.
Fine. Scott Derrickson. You made Sinister, and I really appreciate that.
You know what else he made?
What else did he make?
The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Which was boring.
Ugh.
It was real boring.
That movie was a sack of garbage.
Was Sinister a fluke? Who can say?
Yeah. I mean, I would say the one shred of promise that this shows for Doctor Strange is that he shoots New York in a way that is sort of gritty and urban, and at the same time suggests that there are...
Yeah, it better be gritty and urban. It's New York.
Well, but at the same time suggesting that there are, like, weird mystical forces afoot.
Right. Yeah.
And that's kind of the deal with Doctor Strange. You know, his Sanctum Sanctorum is in the middle of Greenwich Village.
There is a woman in the movie, an actress named Olivia Horton.
Oh, right.
She
possessed mom
is the possessed mommy who throws her kid into the moat at the zoo.
As you do.
That was a great scene. She's like, throw that baby, boom, like into the pit. And the lions get it.
No, they rescue it.
Do they?
I think they do.
Yeah, whatever. In any case, she as the possessed mommy, she's pretty great. She's a maniac from start to finish.
But she's doing all the things that you would expect somebody...
Right, but she's really good at it.
No, I suppose so.
I mean, I'm you know...
So was you know, the Connect the Cuts chick in whatever that terrible movie was. The you remember that really awful January exorcism movie that was a huge hit that ended with a to be continued or visit our website or something, remember?
I don't remember.
You know what I'm talking about.
I right? know, but I don't remember the title.
That thing.
I put it out of my mind as fast as I could.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
So that ended, and then we got a corn dog on a stick, and then we went and bought the mattress. We got the Beautyrest Black Extra Firm.
Black, there's another adjective in there somewhere.
It's like a woman's name.
Like Atria or something.
No, Alexia. They name their mattresses lady names now.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know why they do that. And they show you a picture of like a lady in lingerie right. on the little sign on the thing. I don't understand.
Because straight guys run everything, including big mattress.
She was very pretty. Alexia is very pretty.
Well,
and I liked looking at her because who doesn't like looking at a pretty lady?
Maybe I wanted the Beautyrest Dimitri.
Everybody likes the pretty lady. Pretty ladies like the pretty ladies. Not pretty ladies like the pretty ladies. Heterosexual men like the pretty ladies. I'm a gay person. I like the pretty ladies.
I got no beef with pretty ladies. I just resent the implication that I want to sleep with one, which is what Beautyrest is saying.
No, you're going to sleep on top of one, and she is extra same firm. Difference.
Well, she better be. I'm not light.
I learned a thing this week while mattress shopping.
What's that?
We're going to keep talking about movies, but this is very important.
Welcome to the Mattress Cast.
And that everyone in the world likes a nice, soft mattress that is plush that they can sink down into, apparently. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to be in quicksand while they sleep.
And we were looking
that
for
firm. That is not what I like. I feel like I'm suffocating in a mattress like that. I feel like I can't move when I'm in a sinky down memory foam, soft plushy mattress.
Well, and that's like a selling point. I mean, you see those things where people like have the indentation of their body in one of those memory foam things.
Don't want it.
I don't sleep like that. I move. I roll. You know, so I just I don't get the
hog all the sheets, dude. You roll them up. You roll yourself in them, and then you lie on top of them, so that in the middle of the night, I'm freezing. I get up to pee or whatever, and then I come back, and you are on them all. So I have to yank them out from under you, wake you up.
I don't remember
anything.
And
get good, because it happens like 3 times a week.
Well, you snore. So there.
Not very often.
Lately, less.
Infrequently.
It used to be a lot.
Thanks to my amazing weight loss.
I think the sugar diet is maybe making you less not.
I'm on an all sugar diet right now.
It's working wonders.
It's really, the pounds are melting away.
More jujubes?
Yes, please. So, anyway, there will be more mattress details to come
as we
future
proceed.
Episodes. Let's stop talking about Deliverers from Evil. I want to talk about Earth to Echo, which you did not see.
Oh, right. Yes. I forgot it. That was this week, too. Yeah.
I was pretty proud of my little tagline on movies.com.
Which was E-terrible? No.
Which is what I write. The website I currently write for is movies.com. And no, they still have not posted my Jersey Boys review or many other reviews that I have recently written because things are still all jacked up on the other end.
They posted Tammy and Earth to Echo.
They did post my three main...
And Deliverers from Evil.
They posted Deliverers from Evil and Tammy and Earth to Echo this week. So thanks, employer. Why...
How about Snowpiercer?
Is nothing else happening? No.
Ooh.
No. I did not write a Snowpiercer review for movies.com because my earlier independently released, limited release
have still not gone up.
And I'm not just going to send a review out into nothing and let it sit there forever.
Right. We'll be talking about Snowpiercer shortly as well. But
so if I sound a little cranky about my employer, then that's because I am. I'm grateful to have a job.
Yes.
They're bugging me right now.
What was your tagline?
Selfie tea. Ha ha! Yay! I'm amazing!
Good one.
Congratulations to me.
Good one.
I'm victorious at this.
Why don't you explain that joke to people who haven't seen the film?
Some kids on bikes, they ride around the desert in Nevada. Their phones have all attracted them to a buzzing little signal. Looks like a map. They follow the map. They find an alien. The little alien is like a little... he looks like he's about 9 or 10 inches big.
It looks like the owl from Clash of the Titans.
Little robot, metallic little robot owl with big eyes. He's real cute, you know. He doesn't have a name. They name him Echo. He has no personality at all. This is not E.T. in that respect, where he's like all wrinkly and cute. He looks like a little old man, and you want to pinch his cheek and hug him. And
he's like Benjamin Button.
Feed him a candy and stuff. No, this is a little machine thing. And it responds to yes and no questions with a series of beeps and clicks, like one beep for yes and two for no. Echo leads the kids on an adventure of...
a merry chase.
Assemblage, because Echo wants to build something, and he has the power to assemble and disassemble things whenever he wants. And so there's some fun... you know, sequences where things are flying through the air and, you know, coming together and splitting apart and that kind of stuff.
And then he builds a death ray and destroys humanity. The end.
And then the bad adults are chasing them because there are adults that know about Echo and they want the kids out of the way and stuff like that.
Trumpy, you can do magic.
It is all shot through what looks to be, you know, a smartphone.
Like, that's the premise.
The kids are
the
ones
by their point of view,
doing everything on phones. And Echo only sees through their phones. Does that make sense? No, it does not. But that's not what happens. So
even if they're pointing their phone at Echo, Echo can see through their phone at them, even though they're not the ones on camera?
Yes.
Huh.
Something like
that. That makes no sense whatsoever.
It does not, but it doesn't matter. I'm of two minds about this film. The review I wrote for movies.com, I take an optimistic point of view regarding what this movie is saying about children and their obsession with little phones. You can read it as the death of everything because...
yeah, Amy Nicholson in LA Weekly...
oh, did she?
...talked about how... like,
that's funny.
It pictures these kids...
I gotta go read her review.
...super reliant upon their little screens and unable to just sort of do things on their own.
On the other hand, because the focus is taken off the alien, really, a lot, the kids are actually sort of focusing on each other. And they are navigating their own sort of traumatic stuff with each other for the bulk of the film. What's happening is that they're all about to be displaced. They're all about to have to move away because there's a giant freeway that's being built through their neighborhood, and they've all had to... All the homes got bought up, and they all had to move away.
They've all been eminent domain.
They've all been eminent domained out of their neighborhood. And so the movie is really about, in one real way, about these kids having to, you know, figure out how they're going to be friends when they don't get to live in the same cool little neighborhood anymore.
Phones!
And one of the answers is their phones. Like, they can text. You know, they'll still be connected and communicating even if they're not close together. It's kind of a bummer when you think about it. Mm-hmm. But on another level, it's not too much of a bummer because I think about my own life, really, when I think about this. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, when I was 13... I said this very sentence on one of the stories I told on KCRW's Unfictional.
You were that kid who disappeared.
If I am remembered at all by anyone that I went to elementary school or middle school with, it is as the kid who disappeared. I was abruptly yanked out of my school, my town, my state, and moved across the country with no warning. No advance, anything, no planning, no organization. And read into that what you will. But but that is what happened to me. I was 13. I was in eighth grade. I was removed from my environment quickly, just like that. One day I was in class. The next day I was not in class. The day I was in class, I thought I would be back at school the very next day. The very next day, I was not in class.
Did you have library books?
Within 5 days. Oh, those library books remained overdue forever. I was uprooted, taken out. It's funny you bring up those library books because a letter forwarded to me from the library saying how much I owed in fines, like, 3 months later. And I was like, I don't live in that state anymore. I'm a kid. I don't know what to do. I don't have any money. Mom, my library books. And she's like, too bad. I was like, no, not too bad. We have to do something. The police are coming for me and my books.
I'm a fugitive.
And so,
Yeah, no, so nowadays kids have Facebook.
If you move away when you're in middle school now, you can be like, I'll stay in touch with you maybe, unless you turn out to be a really crazy, awful person later in life.
No, I think I actually...
Facebook has reconnected me to high school people. Yeah. I enjoy chatting with at least two or three of them. The rest of them have all become, you know...
I had a good
deeper right wing annoyances than I ever imagined possible. But.
I had a good friend in middle school, and I think like at the beginning of high school, he moved because his dad was in the military. Mm-hmm. And then he actually visited a couple times from wherever he had moved to back to Atlanta. And then I completely lost touch with him. And I periodically will look for him on Facebook, and I've never tracked him down. I don't know what this guy's deal is, but I just every so often I think, where is he?
Well, here's the funny thing. All those, because I am of the age that I am, I'm 50 now, a lot of the people I went to middle school and elementary school with, they just aren't on Facebook. They just don't care. They don't, they're not.
They have kids.
It's, and or grandchildren by this point. True. And so they don't, they're not in social media. Because I've looked for a couple of them. Like, I've had, like, a couple of, you know, the people who were my best friends in middle school. I had, you know, two of them. And so I have tried to find them. They're unfindable. The one person I found was the kid I lived next to in the trailer park where we lived.
Mm-hmm.
He's in prison.
Well, that's great.
Remember that? I told you about that.
Yes.
Yeah. He's in prison for all kinds of fraud. And he's going to be there for a while. But you can find him. His case is he's in. You can find out what prison he's in. Everything. He's in the joint. Yeah. He was great. He was a funny kid. He was in all the, you know, advanced classes. You know, we were all, like, they tracked
bookkeeping.
You. They tracked you from fourth grade on in my school district. Mm-hmm. They separated you out and put you into, you know, smart kid and dumb kid classes.
That was my school.
Without even telling you, like, you had no idea why they were doing
this. Oh, but you knew.
Well, you knew after a while. Like, after about a year of that, you were like, wait a second. We're all still being put in the same classes, and we're all being separated from other kids.
Yeah.
And then you realize that there are some super goons in the other classes, and you wonder why none of the goons are in your class. And it's because you've been tracked into, these are the kids who are probably going to go to college.
But then you all have PE together.
And then you all have PE together, and then you get, like, the dodgeball thrown at your balls. Yeah.
Earth to echo.
But he was in, he's in prison now. His kid's in prison. His last name is Felch.
Oh, poor guy.
I'm not kidding. That is his last name.
Mm.
That's probably why he's in prison.
Yeah, I'm sure high school was a nightmare.
Yeah.
So Earth Echo, good, bad,
it's all right. It's a good kid movie. Yeah. Like, kids will like it, I think. It's one of those movies where kids have the power and the wisdom and they know the truth. And the adults, all the adults, their hearts have died and blah, 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 blah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. It's not terrible.
All right. Tammy.
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 I wish Bibbs were here. He walked right up to us at the Arclight the other night, and he sang the Tammy theme to us.
He did.
I was like, you never cease to amaze me with your utter weirdness, William Bibbiani.
And maybe take it down a notch. We're indoors.
No.
Just volume-wise.
He should never take it down a notch.
Just volume-wise, not in context.
In the lobby of the Arclight, who cares how volumized you are? That is William Bibbiani.
He don't care.
He's going to sing the theme from Tammy.
And he will.
And he will. I'm going to make him do it again next time I see him somewhere. Friend, sing that theme.
Well, that turned out to be one of the highlights of the evening, as it turned out. So, because then we had to see the movie.
I laughed quite a bit through Tammy.
I laughed a few times, not nearly enough.
But it is...
It's a hot mess.
It is a disappointment. And I'm sad to say that because I think...
Absolutely.
We've said this so many times. We love Melissa McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
We think she's great. Going all the way back to Gilmore Girls when she was Sookie St. James.
That's right.
And Groundlings. Mm-hmm. She's been so great with Groundlings stuff live here in Los Angeles. Yeah. We've seen her do that. She's really funny. She's really appealing. You're rooting for her
right.
all the time.
And I
do not watch Mike and Molly because that is not a good show.
I admire the fact that, Hollywood was not lining up to get in the Melissa McCarthy business. They find themselves there because she's so talented and amazing that she has broken through. And so here you have a movie that she produced and her husband directed and they wrote together. And so you think, okay, if nobody else gets what makes Melissa McCarthy tick and how to showcase her in the best way, surely Melissa McCarthy understands that. Not so fast.
Somebody came along. This is my theory. I have no evidence for this because I was not there, but eventually we're going to hear the stories. Mm-hmm. Someone we know somewhere
knows
something.
I heard a story.
Did you?
Yes.
Is it something that you can share?
Yeah.
Or could that story be traced back to the person?
No, I think it's vague enough that it's not like one person would know this thing.
Okay.
Basically, what I was told was that after Bridesmaids and, Oscar nomination and all that stuff, that studios were, we want to work with you, what do you got?
Right.
And they didn't have a lot ready to jump out of the drawer.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like, well, my husband and I have kind of been working on this character.
Yeah.
And great, we'll take it. Okay. And so they got like a reasonable budget, I think like 10 mil or something.
That's smallish. What they give you. Yeah.
And like, go to town, do it, make it happen. And they did, and they called all of their buddies, and they, half the cast of The Way, Way Back is in this movie, and, Dan Aykroyd and Sandra Oh and Kathy Bates. And I mean, like, they got all, these amazing people that they give, most of them get very little to do.
Yeah.
They got Susan Sarandon. And I have seen...
And some very nice fake edema feet on Susan Sarandon.
Yes, yes.
Like, that was a good makeup job.
Yes.
Whatever they did to make her feet look all swollen and red and diabetic. Yeah.
The thing is...
I know that's not really enough selling point.
No, but it's... But kudos.
But it's a thing that I
to
noticed.
The makeup department.
Like good edema feet.
Yes. The problem with this movie, for starters, is Tammy. Like, this character doesn't make any sense.
No.
On the she starts out, and it's like, it's Melissa McCarthy, she's driving in a Corolla, she's singing along to Freedom Rock, her hair's...
She's a garbage pail kid.
Jacked up disaster. Yeah. Her car is covered in, like, Cheetos wrappers. It's a crappy old herself.
She's a mess.
She hits a deer.
She's not smart. She doesn't know who Mark Twain is.
Yeah, there's, like, smoke coming out of the car. She gets fired from her cruddy fast food job.
And she's 40 and works at a fast food restaurant, so you wonder what that... means.
Yeah, but then she
but
goes
it's never explained.
She goes home and home is a lovely little suburban cottage where she is married to Nat Faxon, who seems very kind of uptight and prim and whatnot.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, wait, she's married to him in this house, how's that work?
Like, was she someone else before? And then has gone down a spiral, and we don't know about that because we are not told.
Yeah, and then we meet her mother, and her mother's Allison Janney, and her mother also very kind of prim and upstanding. And you're like, wait, where? What planet did Tammy come from that she has nothing to do with these people around her? They don't seem like they would have somebody as messed up as her in their life. Right. And then she goes off on this grand road trip with her grandmother, and that's all sort of thrown together, and later we find out things about their relationship that are sort of like, whoa, why didn't you tell me that half an hour ago?
And where was the mother in all of this, like, interpersonal trauma?
Yeah.
No one tells us about this. And then, boom, midway point of the movie, she gets a makeover.
Yeah, and suddenly...
A physical makeover where she's in... Like
they iron her hair.
They iron her hair. It's nice and
smooth.
Smooth.
They put a blouse on her.
She's got makeup on, and they put a nice blouse on
her. Lesbians, by the way, are giving her the makeover.
Yeah, and then she stops being abrasive and obnoxious and crazy. She starts being soft,
rational,
soft and rational and unsure and easy to cry, like prone to tears. And you think, I'm sorry, what? Who are you? Where?
I thought this was a movie about Tammy.
Is this who you were before you became a messed up crazy person? And now you're back to being yourself? Like, did you get bonked on the head somewhere and then get unbonked on the head with the lesbians? Like, it doesn't make sense. I wish it did. Like, yeah. I feel like maybe parts were filmed and cut out, or test audiences didn't like something, or because, well, you know when I think she's at her best? When she's being the Garbage Pail Kid.
Well, yeah.
When she's being balls to the wall crazy.
And she's clearly desirous to do that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's weird. This movie is, it's sold like this wacky, you know, Melissa McCarthy comedy. And then halfway through, it starts feeling like, as one critic pointed out, it's like a bad Nebraska.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, the tone's all over the place. The character doesn't make any sense. You know, and then in... Except for Identity Thief, usually in these movies they find a way to legitimately give her a love interest, which is great because you don't want to just be like the wacky fat girl who, you know, has no sexuality.
Yeah.
You know, she, Ben Falcone, her husband, plays the air marshal that she seduces in Bridesmaids, you know, and that works.
Successfully.
Yeah. He is one of the guys in The Heat.
She gets the guy at the end of Bridesmaids.
Yeah, and in The Heat, there's like a running joke of men who've slept with her once and are like dying to sleep with her again, and she's like, yeah, no, I can't
be bothered. So she gets all the guys in The Heat.
Like,
and this movie...
They throw out Mark Duplass at us, but with no plausible anything, and you never see the point at which they go from being... They have chemistry. They bounce off each other comedically well.
Yeah.
But there's never that aha moment of, ah, yes, you guys were fated to be together. It's more that moment of, aha, you're the leading lady and I'm the guy, so I guess now we're a couple.
The movies, mainstream films, aren't used to giving the guy to that woman.
Right.
And she has made a point of making sure, I don't know if it's her or she has been, you know, given scripts where that is happening, and that's great because it's annoying that it doesn't happen so routinely that we don't even think about it.
Right.
But here's what's weird about this one. Like, she gets the guy in Bridesmaids, she gets all the guys in The Heat, but it is in a very comedic, aggressive sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
Here, it is soft and sweet and romantic.
And phony.
And that is even... And the soft and sweet and romantic side of that kind of scenario is less seen even than the version of it that we saw in Bridesmaids or The Heat. Another character, another big woman comedic character in the media who gets all the guys is Retta on Parks and Recreation.
Oh, well, I was going to say, what's her face from Pitch Perfect?
Rebel Wilson.
Rebel Wilson, thank you.
So I guess maybe that what we can say is that in a comedy setting, that woman is allowed to get the guy.
Right.
Because it's a sort of reverse joke. You know?
It's the way that... large bearded gay men are treated in the mainstream media. That the idea that such people are sexually attractive is hilarious.
I guess. And I guess that's part of it. But, with the sheer force of will of Melissa McCarthy and someone like Retta, they sell it in this way that is absolutely believable. And the reason that it is absolutely believable is because in real life it is absolutely believable.
Yes.
Because in real life, fat people get down.
Mm-hmm.
And they get down with all kinds of other people, not just other fat people.
Yes. Shut up, Rex Reed.
And so, Rex Reed, go eat a bag of D's. And so, but the problem here is that sweetness just becomes this sort of mushy nothing.
Yeah, they don't give her a new character to become when she stops being the hot mess. She can be funny.
Here's the other problem. She can be very funny even when she is playing a person more like herself, a very sort of sweet, kind person.
Or like in This Is 40, where she's playing just like a typical mom but who's high strung or whatever.
Yeah, I was going for the idea of her storyline on Gilmore Girls.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Where she was like the kind-hearted, sweet friend to Lauren Graham, and she gets the guy in Gilmore Girls. She gets Jackson. She gets Jackson the vegetable guy. And they are both still very funny, even during this sweet romantic storyline that they had. Because that show was so well-written and so smartly written. And this feels like pieces of the movie have been chopped out.
You have to wonder, like, surely Toni Collette didn't sign on for the...
To be silent.
For the 8 seconds like of nothing that she's on screen. So, it's quite possible that there are big chunks of this thing missing. I don't know that it would have made them any better, because, like I said, the Tammy character, her arc makes no sense, and her placement in this universe makes no sense.
All right, so talk about Venus and Fur.
Okay.
Because I did not see it.
So it's the new Roman Polanski movie, and it is another one of his theatrical adaptations. You know, he goes...
I was not a huge fan of...
you hated Carnage, I remember.
Carnage.
I liked that one. But, you know, he did Death and the Maiden. He did... He's done... over the years, he's done quite a few of these.
Right.
This one is so super stagey because it is about an actress auditioning for a director. So it's actually set in a theater on a stage. I mean, it's locked down.
Oh, so it's like Audition.
Kind of.
Does it get all cool like Audition?
Not the way you're thinking, but it's basically...
Then I'm not interested.
So Matthew Amalric looking frighteningly like Polanski. Like, they wigged him, or they did his hair, whatever. They made him...
But Matthew Amalric already looked like young Roman Polanski.
But they play that up. I'll just put it that way. They don't go running from it.
Right.
He is this uptight director. He is doing a stage adaptation of the novel Venus and Furs. And you know, he's been seeing terrible actresses all day, and then, like, at the last minute, a rainstorm, in comes a very bedraggled Emmanuelle Seigner, who is, you know, Mrs. Polanski in real life, to audition for the play, and at first she seems like a mess and an idiot, and yada-da-da-da, but then as it goes along, then obviously, like, she super knows the material and really understands the character and is, like, playing crazy mind games with the director, and it turns out that he is closer to the material than we thought, and she begins to dominate him, and is he blah, 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 blah. You know where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
You know this is going to be one of those male-female power play situations, accentuated by the fact that it's about two people putting on a play about male-female power situations. And so within that, it's okay, you know? I mean, he does a good job of making it claustrophobic, and the characters... I mean, the performances are interesting, and, you know, there's an interesting kind of interplay between them. And, you know, by the time she's, like, getting him to put on makeup, it's like watching Polanski in his own movie, The Tenant.
Are you still talking about this movie? What movie are you talking about?
Venus
still?
And Fur.
Oh, you're still talking about it?
Yes.
Okay, I've stopped listening.
Oh, my God. You're the worst. I paid more attention to Earth to Echo, for God's sake. So it's fine, I guess.
I'm not harshing on your delivery. This just sounds like nothing I want to see.
I think, frankly, if you want to see a two-person movie about a man and a woman kind of playing head games on each other... And
I guess I'm going to have to see it now, because it's a Roman Polanski movie, and he's, you know...
There's not going to be that many more of them.
There's not going to be any more of them, and if I'm already sort of irritated by it, then obviously I have to look at it now.
What I was going to say is, if you want to see a movie that's sort of, you know, the male-female interplay and who's zooming who and all that stuff, check out new on DVD, Some Velvet Morning, with Stanley Tucci and Alice Eve. It's a Neil LaBute movie that I think is a better variation on this theme. But, you know, Venus and Fur is fine for what it is. I just, what it is does not interest me all that much.
All right.
What else are we talking about this week?
Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer, yes, by popular demand.
I did not write a review of it.
Right.
Because maybe I'll write one for linoleum-knife.com.
That would be great.
Our website, which hosts original content
mm-hmm.
that we write. And very specifically, a series of films about summertime that I am working on. The first one that I wrote recently is a... I won't say it's very long, but it's about twice the length of a normal review that I would put for onmovies.com. About 1960s documentary Chronicle of a Summer,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the great, great documentaries it of is the 20th century.
It is a documentary that changed documentaries.
A lot of things, yeah. It not only changed documentaries, it changed narrative film as well.
Sure, yeah.
So you should go to linoleum-knife.com, and read that thing I wrote about Chronicle of a Summer. And don't be all too long didn't read. Go read it.
Yes.
It'll take you 10, 15 minutes.
And then you go watch the movie on Hulu Plus.
I'm pretty great, I think.
you were paid a very nice compliment by a coworker of mine who is a grad student. She thought it was very interesting. It encouraged her to want to see it again.
Yeah. The also on linoleum-knife.com is this podcast that you can listen to streaming on the site. And also, it's where you can go buy commentaries that we have done, extra episodes, we call them. Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knife.
We don't have a store page set up yet, but
we don't have a store page, instructions on how to get them. But we're going to have one soon.
Yes.
And you can, they're easy to find. Look around, you'll find them. Those are $1.99.
Yep.
PayPal. And
so far, we have done
White Christmas and Clue and The Apple and 1967's Two for the Road with Audrey Hepburn and Albert Finney from Stanley Donen. And we're fixing to do Josie and the Pussycats.
Yes, our goal is to do it in the next...
We believe in Josie and the Pussycats. Yes. We were supposed to do it, last week, maybe the week before, but life is very busy for Alonzo Duralde, who's got Outfest coming up.
Starting on Thursday, so the idea is that we
will tape it before then. If you live in Los Angeles, you should go to Outfest things.
Yeah, outfest.org for the full schedule.
But Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer. Yes, so Bong Joon-ho's English language debut. He is best known for a very cool monster movie called The Host and a very cool murder mystery called Mother. But both of those films are sort of genre films that are really about something else. And
he takes genre convention and he bends it.
Yeah. And you could say the same...
Pushes the weirdnesses.
You could definitely say that Snowpiercer falls into that category.
Yes.
It's set in the near future, and we have screwed the planet because in an attempt to rebuild the ozone layer to reverse climate change, we've plunged the Earth into another ice age. And the only people left alive are the people who are on this amazing train called the Snowpiercer that travels around the world. The super rich people are up in front, and the very poor are in the back and are not treated well.
Nope.
And they basically foment a revolt to get to the front of the train. Yep. And so it's this big rolling metaphor about the class struggle, and it's a lot of fun and very exciting and provocative. And then it ends. I don't know that they really quite thought that ending out all that well. It doesn't. Some movies you kind of feel like they thought the ending first and then figured out they backtracked on how to get there. And then some movies it's like this great idea and they're chugging along, literally in this case. And then you realize you don't know where this is going. And this is co-written by Bong and Kelly Masterson, who wrote one of my favorite films of recent years, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. And it's got an amazing cast. Chris Evans, who is terrific, is the first non-Captain America thing I've seen him in.
Tilda Swinton
with crazy dentures and a wig that's nutty and weird glasses. Jamie Bell and John Hurt and Octavia Spencer and Allison Pill and all kind of folks. And I really like this movie, but I really... don't know how I feel about the last 10 minutes.
I think of it as sort of an homage to Terry Gilliam.
Sure.
It's as if, like, Terry Gilliam made...
Murder on the Orient Express.
And the Poseidon Adventure. Like, all mixed together. You know, because the idea is we must get to the engine room.
Right.
You know,
go from car to car.
And
it has that sort of video game thing of, like, each car is a level, you know.
So it's a lot of fun. I think that Mr. Bong...
Mm-hmm.
Maybe has some way to go with his ability to hear English speakers acting.
How so?
Well, the performances in this film, and it's hard to know if they are intentionally meant to be
stylized
and arch and
big
and weird, or if
he just didn't know the difference.
He just isn't used to listening to, you know, what makes
the subtleties
a sound. You know, what makes someone sound authentic in English And I could be completely wrong about this. He may be sort of, you know,
fluent.
Fluent in ways that I would never be in Korean, but it has a bit of an ESL quality to it, the English. That's just how it felt to me on first viewing. I need to go, you know, look at it again.
Right.
And I probably will, because it's a lot of fun.
It is. It's very exciting.
It's a lot of fun. It's very cool looking. And it's not like nothing else right now in theaters in you know, in medium release.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the Transformers, don't see the Transformers.
Go see this instead.
Go see Snowpiercer, sir.
Yeah.
Come on.
All right, life itself.
Life itself, which you've not seen.
I have not seen yet, but I'm going to.
Documentary based on Roger Ebert's memoirs, directed by Steve James, who did Hoop Dreams. And originally, the idea was to do kind of a straightforward doc about Roger Ebert. And then right around the time they started making the movie is when Roger Ebert started not being in good health.
Yeah.
And so all the sort of the quote-unquote new footage of Ebert is mostly of him in the hospital or, you know, being shuttled around, you know, in his recovery, but not speaking. You know, he's communicating through a laptop, and his wife Chaz is there, and there's a lot of long shots of Roger Ebert with no lower jaw, and you can just see all the way through his mouth to his neck, basically.
Interesting.
Yeah. And you see his...
That was all covered up in public.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely... The photos that you saw, like in Esquire and other things, they were definitely niced up, you know. I saw him in person a few times.
Yes.
Like at the Spirit Awards and stuff. So I, you know, but I had never really gotten that close of a glimpse of it. And you see his throat get irrigated, which is, you know, he actually says, I'm glad that's in the movie, but it's right. difficult to watch.
Right.
But, you know, it's an amazing life story. Here's a guy who, you know, I think his father was an electrician, you know, in Urbana, Illinois, just completely kind of working class family.
Right.
Who just knew from an early age, I'm going to be a writer. He'd made like a little neighborhood newspaper that he would send around. And, you know, he was the editor of the Daily Illini at the University of Illinois. And it was during a really interesting period. You know, he stopped the presses after the JFK assassination because there was some ad next to a story about JFK that involved like something exploding or a gun or something, like it was like, you know, boom of savings. I forget what, but yeah, just something that was inappropriate. And he made them redo it. He wrote this amazing op-ed about the four little girls in Birmingham.
Uh-huh.
You know, so you see this guy, you know, not so much as like the birth of a cineast as much as of a newspaper man, you know, an old school newspaper man.
Right.
And, you know, he goes to work for the Sun-Times and, you know, becomes their film critic, but is also one of a group of kind of hard drinking raconteurs that would hang out at this like working class bar in Chicago. And, you know, he has recovered from alcoholism.
Oh, he was an alcoholic?
Oh, yeah. He talked about it a lot, actually. Later on in his writings and stuff. And he talked about it on Stern and stuff. In this movie, actually, Chaz Ebert admits for the first time that she and Roger met in AA. That she is also a recovering alcoholic.
I
and had never talked about that publicly, but it's in the film.
Spoilers!
You know, and then the
does he talk about me?
It does not come up, unfortunately. his massive feud with you over Crash is not mentioned, sadly. But you will always have that to treasure.
Yes. massive feud.
Our friend Bennett is still proud of the fact that he co-wrote, I think, the English language version of Little Indian Big City.
I didn't know that.
This is a movie that Ebert soundly trashed.
Bennett wrote that?
Yeah.
Bennett wrote Dumb and Dumber.
Yes, that's his main.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah.
So he didn't just write that. So anyway, yeah, and then of course the whole middle section is about Gene Siskel and their show, and that's fascinating. Like there could have been a whole movie just about that period because it's, you know, their relationship was so crazy and competitive and, you know, loving and hating and all that stuff at the same time. And Siskel, it turns out, while Ebert was having his Russ Meyer period, Siskel was in the Hef entourage for several years.
What?
Well, you know, Hef used to be Chicago based before he moved out to LA.
Right.
And so there's literally in this movie a picture of Gene Siskel standing in the water under a waterfall next to a topless lady and totally staring down her cleavage. I'm like,
it was the 70s.
It was so the 70s.
People were different then.
Yeah.
People were ready to get freaky back then all the time. It's such a weird...
They were DTF.
We were children during all that. Mm-hmm. We had no idea any of that was going on.
Yeah, but like there were, you know, you would get these sort of... The culture would trickle down to you in a way, so like you would hear the name Linda Lovelace, but not be quite clear like, why she was famous.
She's famous. What did she do?
Yeah.
She ended up dirty. This is what I used to think about porn when I was a kid. When I would hear the name Linda Lovelace, I would think, she's in the movies where people are naked.
Mm.
And they roll around and they kiss or something. Like they're like ladies or... Ladies have their boobies, and then the man is kissing the boobies. Like that was what I was always thinking. Like the man kisses the boobs.
Yes, and that's
and dirty. That's dirty, and that's rated X. That's all I as much as I understood.
So that stuff is all really interesting about their relationship, and then it's about it touches on a lot of things, like, you know, Ebert, how he would champion young filmmakers, how, like, he apparently wrote one of the first reviews of one of Scorsese's early features, and how that really kept him going, and Scorsese's an executive producer of this, and, you know, they talked to people like Gregory Nava and Werner Herzog, and people like, you know, more contemporary, like Ramin Barani and Ava DuVernay and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you get to know about Roger's relationship with Chaz, you know, his final years where he lost the capacity to speak, but then found this whole new voice on the internet and became this amazing blogger and did some of his very best writing.
Right.
So, I mean, if you love Ebert, if you love the movies, you know, it's gripping and it's moving. It left me wanting more, which I guess is a good thing, but there were certain, like, I know Ebert's written about the time he spent in South Africa when he was a college student that I think really kind of shaped a lot of his views on a lot of issues, and I would have liked to know more about that.
Yeah.
A lot of different things, but, you know, and again, more of the Siskel stuff I think was really interesting, but for what it is, it's a fine film. People should totally check it out. We reviewed it on What the Flick this week, and Ben Mankiewicz, who, of course, was one of the follow-ups to Ebert on At the Movies
for
a year.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I forget
from time to time. Ben Lyons, right?
Yes. Anyway, Ben talked about how he goes, the thing...
I forgot about that. That's hilarious.
He goes, the thing that people don't remember about Siskel and Ebert is that when they started, they were terrible.
Oh, were they?
Yeah. You see some of their early work. Like,
I watched that show right from the get-go when I was a kid.
But here's the thing. You and I did not see it from the get-go because there were a couple seasons that were just on the Chicago station.
Before
it went national.
PBS.
Yeah. So by the time we saw it, they had enough shows under their belt that they were better at it. But they show you clips of like their very first episode together, and they're stiff and awkward, and they had not sort of created that rhythm,
right?
You know, I definitely recommend it. I would have liked more of certain things, but it's definitely worth it.
When they make the documentary about me,
this is probably the biggest documentary about a film critic we will see in our lifetime.
When they make the one about me,
uh-huh.
I'll make sure that there's a plenty of footage of my time as a dishwasher in college that really shaped me.
That's a story that people need to know.
Yes. The people have a right to know. I do need to clarify something about that. There was not a massive feud.
No, I was teasing.
Between me and Ebert, I had the distinct pleasure
of being called out.
Of being called out in an angry way. Like, he was upset at me because I...
Dear Diary, he knows my name.
I know, it was so exciting. He, when Crash came out, not the good David Cronenberg one, but the terrible
Oscar-winning
one about racism is bad. I made a point of mocking it every single chance I could do it in print.
Yeah.
And I did have the chance a couple times. I wrote the review that I wrote, and then I had the opportunity to mock it again on MSNBC. And I think he may have seen the MSNBC piece.
You're awful is the new awesome list.
And he went off on me by name. He called me smug and cruel and just all sorts of... he was mad. And I was like, the guy who wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is mad at me. I exist in his brain for 5 whole seconds. And I've never been so happy to be so vilified in that moment. Because, I mean, he loved Crash.
Oh, yeah.
He was a big defender of Crash. Mm-hmm. He was wrong.
Yes.
And
also about Speed 2 Cruise Control.
And but he's so great. And yeah. I just was so happy. Like, when it happened, people were like, are you... How do you feel? He's all mad at you. I was like, I feel great.
I'm on his radar.
I feel great. He's the coolest dude. Roger Ebert said my name. He typed it out.
I told my story, I think, last year when he passed away. But, I mean, I did meet him.
You met him several times. Film festival stuff. And
We passed each other quite a few times. Yeah. The major time that I spent time with him, he and Chaz came to the USA Film Festival my first year there. It was the 25th anniversary, and he had been a real champion of the festival in its early years. And so it was great to have him back. And Gregory Nava had a new film that year, Mi Familia, and we had... There was a documentary about the first 100 years of cinema that Chuck Workman directed. And he was great. I mean, believe me, of all the idols that I've met that have been disappointing, he was not one of them. He was sweet and smart and really, you know, gave me good advice and was very supportive of this kid who was in way over his head running this film festival, and was great. And I will be eternally grateful for that. And Chaz is always very sweet when I see her. And so, we had a moment.
Yeah. We're going to save Monica Mana for next time because there are very few films coming out next week. Okay. And because currently Monica Mana is not playing anywhere in the country. Mm-hmm. By the time we talk about it next week, it will be somewhere.
New.
Yeah. It's on a very, very, very slow rollout across the country. And it's going from like spot to spot to spot. And actually, I will talk about where it's going to be. But there's a lengthy story involving Monica Mana now. Not only the one involving you and me seeing it, but the one involving me seeing it at the press screening. I've now seen this film twice.
Oh, yeah, there's that story.
When you get the chance, do see this film. It's one of my favorite movies of the year.
And you can read Dave's review of it at linoleum-knife.com.
I wrote a review of it at linoleum-knife.com. How many minutes have we been on doing this?
Right now? 77.
77?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to kick it through some letters.
Okay.
And then
we've already done our DVD. We've done mix, everything. So.
Yeah. All right. I've got that. I'm taking this out of the thing and the stuff. Hello, David Alonzo. I keep seeing commercials for the movie Tammy. This is a timely letter. And I am starting to think that this may end up being the point where people begin to turn on Melissa McCarthy. Now, I hope this doesn't
happen. I hope not.
Yeah. I thought that she was good in Bridesmaids and even better in The Heat, but she seems to be playing variations of the same abrasive character in all of her movies, and this one just looks like a huge dud to me. I've always felt that critics were going a little overboard in their praise of her. Now, I don't feel like I'm overboard. I just think she's really great, and I've thought she was that way for a long time.
Yeah.
I'm enthusiastic about her because
we were into her before she was cool.
I'm excited that now this person that I've been a fan of all this time is suddenly huge. Super famous. Yeah. I think that's so great. It seems inevitable that a backlash will eventually come around. I don't know if either of you gentlemen have seen Tammy yet. Well, yes, we have. Why don't you listen to this episode?
We'll wait.
But I was wondering if you would agree that people are going to get tired of seeing her do the same thing in every movie. No, I don't think they will. I think basically we've got Lady Galifianakis here. And if she can be used appropriately, she can, you know, keep going and doing this thing.
But even Zach Galifianakis will turn out the occasional, it's kind of a funny story or whatever.
And,
you know?
And she will do the same thing.
Well, apparently I think this St. Vincent of Van Nuys or whatever it's called now, they keep changing the title, the Bill Murray movie that she's in.
Oh, okay.
This coming at the end of the year. It looks like she's playing a calmer than usual character. So
I'd also be interested in knowing whether you think that she is choosing these roles because she doesn't want to fix something that she feels isn't broken. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, well. Believe me, Tammy is totally her vision, you know.
Or if it's more likely that opinions in Hollywood about her size and physical appearance are keeping her from being able to do something different. Thanks, Eric in Washington, D.C. I don't think that her size is a big factor right now. maybe in the past it was, you know, in being cast in this or that, who knows. But it's like that joke on 30 Rock when Jenna gains a little weight and Alec Baldwin says, you've either got to lose 30 or gain 60.
No one in between has any room on television.
Yeah. So basically, if you are a big person, a big woman, a big man, you'll get work. It'll be the same kind of work, I think,
right,
over and over and over again.
Well, and I think this is a tough enough business for funny women who look like Tina Fey.
Right.
You know, or just women in general.
Yes.
You know, no matter what their size. The fact that she is also a woman that the average studio executive probably has decided is not sexually attractive is another challenge for her, but not an insurmountable one.
Right. I think comedy also fits into this as well.
Sure.
There is room for more body types in comedy.
Sure.
Because comedy wants more body types.
Right.
Pretty, you know, conventionally skinny, blah, blah, all those things that studio execs are, you know, seemingly the most into, casting directors are seemingly the most into. That doesn't necessarily hold in comedy, you know, as much.
Unless you're making the other woman, you know.
I suppose, yeah. Dave White, all one word, and Al.
To paraphrase Paul Simon, you can't call me Al.
I have been listening to your show for almost 2 years now.
Yay!
Why not 3.5? What's wrong with you?
We'll take him when we get him.
And we will also scold you.
The old episodes are still there online. You can find them at our at libsyn.com. And at some point, I'm going to put them all on, make them all YouTube clips once.
Really?
Yeah,
really?
That's what the schmoes do. And once I can get Mark Ellis to sit down,
those guys know about how to brand too.
Uh huh.
They're well known
once,
now.
Yeah, once I can get Mark to sit me down and show me
everything wrong,
how to do that, I'm going to do it. And I'm sure I'm going to get emails of people explaining to me how to do it. I'm like, I don't know. And somebody has to actually sit here with me while I do it.
I listen to a dozen or more podcasts a week.
Wow.
And yours is my favorite by far.
Wow. Well, thanks.
It is the first thing I listen to every Monday during my 2-hour commute.
See, that's why I don't. That's why I don't mind these episodes going long.
You know what? It's okay if you haven't listened all 4 years or 3.5 years or however the hell long we've been doing the show. I feel sad that you have a 2-hour commute to work. I have a 2-second commute to work. Like, I get out of bed, I go to the bathroom, I make myself a cup of tea, I sit at the desk. That's my commute to work. Yeah. The woman at Sears was asking for a work phone number when I went back yesterday to actually buy the bed. Because we laid down on the beds, and then I had to go to Sit and Sleep and check out their mattresses, and it turned out basically the same mattress as what was the one that I wanted. So I finally went back to Sears yesterday and I bought the mattress and the lady helping me said, do you have a work number? And I said, it's the same as my, phone number because I work at home. And she goes, ooh, you're so lucky. And I was like, you're right. I am. I'm totally lucky.
Yeah. You think she gets to sell mattresses in her underwear? No.
No. I do everything in my underpants.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing this in my, actually, this is, I'm wearing my summer weight pajama shorts right now.
Your shorty sets.
The story from a fellow listener about how someone farting in the middle of Major League 2 caused that film to make it to his top 10 list of that year reminded me of my favorite movie-going experience.
Oh, boy.
It happened while watching Superman 2 in 1980. In the film, spoiler warning,
for a 34-year-old
Superman
movie.
Is informed by the spirit, hologram, computer program, what exactly is Lara anyway, of his mother, Lara, that she has to... Laura or Lara?
Lara.
That he has to give up his powers if he wants to be with Lois in the biblical sense. Fortunately, the Fortress of Solitude comes equipped with a superpower-stealing chamber. Superman steps into the chamber, and a red light show in the chamber seems to cause Superman some discomfort. It's taken away his stuff. When he steps out of the chamber and proceeds to give Lois a big non-superpowered hug, a fellow movie patron, in his best Eddie Murphy impression, yells out, "The S is for sucker!" It's the first time I've read through this letter. He may be able to fly all through the night, but can he rock a party till the early light?
Exactly.
Yeah. Causing mirth and hilarity to erupt in the theater. Well, yeah. That guy's the best. All right. I'm not finished reading this letter yet because he changes subjects right away. I would like those to be the letters we get from now on. What is the best thing that's ever happened during a movie to you, listener? Mm. What crazy stuff has gone down in movie theaters that has been great that you love and you want to tell?
I told mine when I saw Halloween 2 on opening night?
Maybe. If you did, I don't remember it.
There's a scene where the teens are having sex. Of course, they get killed. But it's all set in a hospital. Yeah. So they're having sex in like the therapeutic hot tub.
Yes.
And of course, then Michael Myers, cranks the temperature way up. Because, of course, a hospital therapeutic hot tub would have a boil egg setting, just built in. And right. So he turns it way up, and the woman's all... And then so the guy gets out of the tub to go over to the thermostat to fix it. And, of course, then you see him at the corner of the frame getting strangled or whatever
right.
by Michael Myers.
And she doesn't know enough to get out
she
of the hot tub.
No, she doesn't see any of this.
She's boiling.
She's just sitting there going...
Right.
So a woman two rows in front of me yells out, I can't quite do the voice, but it was something along the lines of, girl, he die now, and you ain't going to get no orgasm. Thank you, Halloween 2 moviegoer.
I'm continuing to read this letter.
Okay, yes.
Since I have your attention, I have one complaint about your show.
Oh, really?
When Alonzo posts the show to the internet, for some reason he posts it in that god-awful M4A Apple format. My MP3 player refuses to play M4As, and I have to convert it to an MP3 every week in order to listen to my two favorite portly roommate movie reviewers.
That's going on a shirt.
Daddy's roommate. Congratulations on the weight loss, Dave. Sex happening. Please, for the love of all that is good, make a second link available somewhere that all of us Apple-hating listeners can use to download the show in the format that 99.99999% of all podcasts use. Please. I know Alonzo is doing this on purpose because when Whitney or Bibbs fills in, they post the show in MP3. Please, all caps, please stop the madness. For all our sakes, keep up the good work. Captain Billy. I don't understand a thing about what he just said. So you are going to have to go and address this problem and fix it.
I don't know how to fix it either. I asked,
why don't you know
because
how to fix it?
What's wrong with you? You're lucky that I know what I know. And I did ask someone who would know. And the response was, you got one complaint about this? And I said, yes. And the other person said, too bad.
Do other listeners have a complaint about this? If you have a problem with this thing that we don't understand how to fix, that Alonzo was apparently too lazy to go figure out how to fix.
I'm not a tech-minded person.
Then go.
This is what my app, I'm using an
job.
Apple product. It creates an M4A. I put an M4A.
After Outfest is over, I know this week coming up is going to be a brutal week for you trying to deal with life and Outfest at the same time. But when Outfest is over, you got to figure out what to do about this.
I don't got to do that.
Yeah, you do. For the sake of Captain Billy.
Captain Billy knows...
He's a commute.
Clearly knows how to...
He's very upset at you.
If he's been listening for 2 years and converting it, then I think,
he's not happy, and we need to make... The customer is always right. Get it together.
I'll see.
Fix that thing that is the problem that I don't understand about anything.
If I have time.
Oh, Linoleum Knife Podcast. I so adored your opening banter on the June 1st podcast. That was the episode when we were in Atlanta.
Ah, okay.
When I was complaining about everything.
Yes. So unlike
rightfully
usual.
So. I was right to complain about everything. It was bad and wrong that we had to go to Atlanta and do a podcast when we were supposed to be just visiting family and friends.
And we spent an hour and a half doing that podcast, and then we had a nice lunch with our guest, Kurt Holman.
We could have been having a three-hour barbecue lunch with Kurt Holman and his wife and their lovely child. Instead, we all had to sit around and be a podcasty.
And it was great.
Never again.
You just got a compliment about that podcast.
Oh, you're right. All right, okay. Dave, I can totally relate to the, quote, looking and sounding angry all the time accusations. That's right! People say that about me, mm-hmm. that I look and sound angry all the time.
You do.
I'm not! I'm a delight! Those accusations have placed me in trouble more than once in my personal and professional life. Mm. I'm too old to change now, and I really don't give a flip. He wrote flip.
Oh, okay.
He didn't write the bad swear.
I see.
F. Really don't give a flip what they think anyway. That's right. Go be yourself, man. Yours in metal mugging. That's from M.A. Ross. Okay, I'm going to do one top 10 list.
Okay.
And then we are done. Hi, guys. Hope you are both doing well. I've been listening to back-to-back episodes. No, I'm sorry. I've been listening to back episodes while my dad's been recovering from a car accident. And I've had to do a lot of hospital waiting room sitting. You guys just crack me up!
Woo!
With your Tracy Hepburn banter.
Yeah.
Very desk set. In this scenario, Dave is Hepburn.
All right, bunny.
Yeah. But your last episode made me think about movies. Oh, I'm sorry. For the first time. No, but your last... This is why I should read these letters through.
You might, yes.
But your last episode made me think about movies that I loved as a teenager but may not have watched since. So here are my top 10 movies that I was obsessed with as a teenager. Curious to see how knife I would have been at 15 or 16. Probably not very knife at all because kids are stupid. He's counting down from 10. 10, From Here to Eternity.
Sure,
that's great. Great movie.
Yeah.
He says it's my teenage idea of how romance could be.
With someone else's wife on a beach.
That's right.
Or with prostitutes.
Number 9, Manchurian Candidate.
Great.
I may have had a thing for Sinatra. I was a weird kid. Number 8, The Year of Living Dangerously.
Okay.
The first movie I remember giving me chills, and my parents took my sister and I.
And me.
And me. He wrote I, but it's me. The object is always me. I just want to tell all of you this.
I'm not
calling you out personally.
Letter writer. We hear this all the time in conversation.
Here's a good mnemonic
on television.
To remember this.
Take out the other person.
No. And you don't even need to do that.
Oh, what is it?
Mac and Me. The film that everyone loves about the sweet little alien. The 80s movie about the sweet little alien that befriends a child that everyone loves. Not that E.T. movie.
But
Mac and Me.
But if Mac is the subject of the sentence, it would be Mac and I.
It doesn't matter.
Your mnemonic is terrible.
Always think Mac and Me.
Here's what you do. You take out the other person.
So I'm right.
If you're saying my parents took my sister and I to the movies, then you've got my sister took I to the movies.
Yeah, I know.
It's my sister took me. My parents took me to the movies. My parents took my sister and me to the movies.
My parents took I to the movies is what you would be saying if your sister wasn't in the equation.
Exactly.
It would be wrong.
Correct.
Yeah. It's always and me.
Yeah. When it's the subject.
We are family.
We're the object.
I got all my sisters with I. The Sure Thing.
Love it. It's in my Christmas book.
Waited in vain to meet a guy like the John Cusack of the film. Apocalypse Now.
Sure.
I thought it was really deep and that I was really deep for liking. Parting Glances.
Oh, man. These are great movies.
What high school kid were you, dude?
Sheesh.
Discovered while ditching high school, saw it two more times in the theater.
I bet.
All That Jazz. Still know the words to most of these songs. Still wish I could be Anne Reinking.
Don't we all?
A Hard Day's Night. Amazing. Obsessed with the Beatles. Ringo was my favorite back then. My favorite was always John.
Mm.
And not because I'm so cool and musical and stuff. Mm. When I was a kid, I just was like, oh, John's the cute one. Like, everyone, I think, thought Paul was the cute one. But I thought John was the cute one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a gorgeous new Criterion Blu-ray.
Yeah, Cinefamily is showing A Hard Day's Night right now.
It's getting a bit of a release around the country, but it's also on a great new Blu-ray.
Kiss of the Spider-Woman. This movie made me weep. I adored it and think I saw it in the theater at least 6 times. Wow. Haven't seen it since. Wonder if it holds up.
It does.
The Shining.
Okay.
My best friend Jenny and I memorized the dialogue and used to act it out on the beach together. One person would play Jack, one would play everyone else.
what are your kids doing over there?
And here's another reason why I should read through these letters all the way before I read them. This letter is from Paige Newman, my old boss editor at MSNBC.
Oh, well, there you go.
Which makes it all the more bad that you used the word I.
Yeah, really, the object Paige, of you your were thing. Reading our
you
stuff.
You were my editor.
And you were mine, too.
Paige Newman plucked me out of LiveJournal and got me to come to work for her at MSNBC. Yeah. She found me on LiveJournal out of the blue. She didn't know who I was at all. She stumbled across my page and started reading me and then contacted me and said, would you like to write for me? That was a very cool way to get a job.
And then she hired me to be the film critic at MSNBC, mainly out of being a fan of yours.
Paige
Newman liked my
is
stuff
great.
Too. Yes. Hooray, Paige Newman.
And you're 100% nice.
Oh, my God. Yeah, your teen choices were awesome.
Yeah.
Just not all of your grandma
also, your
choices.
Adult choices in hiring us.
Yes.
Those were
well
also,
done.
Those choices were also awesome. We're done.
Okay. We thank you for listening.
We do.
You can purchase the extra Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes by PayPaling $1.99 to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
You should.
And please include the email address where you'd like that sent. You can also pre-order, and we're getting close to having enough pre-orders to get them. We're gonna
do it this week.
Oh, awesome. Okay,
yeah,
so you can pre-order
ordering the t-shirts this week.
Pre-order a Linoleum Knife t-shirt. It's $20. Again, PayPal linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. For those, include your size. It's a Hanes Beefy Tee 100% cotton black shirt, and include your mailing address where you want the shirt sent. In the meantime, and of course, visit linoleum-knife.com. Go read Dave's Monica Mono review and check out the other links and whatnot that we offer there. Check out our friends in the podcast universe. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Go to Rotten Tomatoes, the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, rather, with Matt and Christy. Dave and I will be on the Derek and Romaine show this
you
Friday.
You mean Dave and me will be
on. Dave and I will be on Derek and Romaine this Friday talking about entertainment stuff, so don't miss that.
Don't miss that.
And also, if you're a SiriusXM listener, check out the Frank DeCaro show. Listen to the B-Movies podcast and the Schmoes Know and Dennis, anyone with Dennis Hensley.
Go make Frank put us on his show too sometime.
He usually has me on during Outfest, so I may be on there soon.
No, I mean me too.
Oh, well, we'll see.
Go make him have me on.
We're
way better together.
I'm going to be talking
You're
about Outfest.
Much less interesting without me.
I'm going to be talking about Outfest on various places this week. I think I'm going on the Rotten Tomatoes podcast. I think I'm going to be going on Del Shores' podcast. The Dell.
He has a new podcast.
He has a new podcast. I think it's the Dell and Emerson show. I forget. Anyway, if you Google Del Shore's podcast, you'll find it. It's a fun show. Also, check out Fat Guys of the Movies. What are you doing?
My phone's
Your
going
stupid
off.
Stupid phone.
My phone's going
Fat
off.
Guys of the Movies, the Criterion cast, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash, The Game Night Guys, Secretly Timid, and The Lunch. We want to thank Blue for our theme music. You can follow his extraordinary career at Blutopia, BLEUTOPIA.com. You can subscribe to this show for free at iTunes. Leave us a review. It helps people find the show. You can stream us at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com or on our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. We are a whisker shy of 1,000 likes, so if you haven't liked us yet, please do so. You can follow
that
us
doesn't
on...
doesn't matter.
It's a nice...
Likes on Facebook do not matter.
It's a nice milestone. It looks nice on print. In print.
It's useless and irrelevant.
Well, so are you.
No. I'm vital to this whole operation. But I know what's important and what ain't.
Great. Thank you.
Likes on Facebook, they ain't important.
Follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast.
I ain't people.
You can check into the show at TVTag.com and email us at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com with questions, comments, top 10 lists, bottom 10 lists, crazy moments in movie theaters that made movies better, complaints about M4A, whatever else you want to write us about. That would be great. And we will catch you next time.
Who's zooming who?
Oh, stop it.
Goodbye.